I'm sure you're more than capable.
You know,
that's right.
Yeah, but what they don't realize is that's right, it does change the ecosystem, the water, the species, habitat, all of those things. So, well, it was very nice meeting you. I'll definitely check out your website. Thank you.
It is Friday. Gosh, June 17th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. That's right, live from Netroots Nation, 2011. I am horribly hungover. I don't know if I'm going to make it for the rest of the convention, folks. So enjoy today's program, because I may never come back. I have obtained the perfect radio voice through my drinking exercises, which involve consuming a massive amount of gin over a short period of time, which has now given me the perfect radio voice. Today on the program. And so we will have another day of interviews and whatnot. And let's kick that off right now with me as I speak. Let me just... come on, folks. Give me a break. All right? No, no, no. Give me a break here. I knew that. My guest thinks that I forgot her name, but I'm actually trying to figure out how to work my iTunes.
I wasn't sure about what level of hangover you were at.
No, I'm at total hangover. I'm just trying to fade out. I'm just giving myself an out ramp. There we go. Okay, now I have a weird dynamic because I'm both broadcasting the feed and the thing going into this box, and so I have like two different types of echoes in my head. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Joan McCarter, or you may know her as McJoan. She is she has a title at Daily Kos. Not only has she been a front page poster there for, what, like 4 or 5 years?
Five years?
But now she has a title, and she told me it 30 seconds ago. I can't remember.
And it is Senior Policy Editor.
Senior Policy Editor of Daily Kos, and I just spoke to Marcos for an interview for Ring of Fire. 18 people working now.
Yeah.
At Daily Kos.
We actually had 2 days of staff meetings.
That's unbelievable. Do you guys go to a trust camp?
We have an office.
You have an office?
Do you have trust camp?
Do you have trust camp where you go? And we're also joined by...
Yeah, nobody expects that Marcos will catch them when they fall, so trust camp doesn't work so much.
At the trust camp. All right, well, that's good to know, I guess. I mean, better... there we see. Yeah, would you speak again, Joan?
I will speak again.
Okay. I think we go. And also now joining us is from at Cliff Schechter on Twitter is...
I actually live there.
You live... Now, all right, now you have to forgive me, guys, because last... In the interview, we switched which mics there are, and I can't tell. I can't tell which one is which. But all right, so we're here with Cliff and Joan. Joan was telling me that Daily Kos now has 18 staff members.
Wow.
Which is stunning. And Cliff, you have no staff members.
I have myself, two cats.
Are we counting cats?
And sometimes I put on sock puppets, and they do some good work. No, I actually have a couple subcontractors who do work with me. Does that count?
No.
No, okay, it doesn't.
No, I mean,
I'd like to congratulate Daily Kos, because what we know is most of the time liberals kill jobs. So I'm rather impressed that somehow a bunch of commies got together and figured out a way to create 18 jobs.
Right.
And they didn't even have to steal anybody's pension to do it.
No.
So it's really rather amazing. No, seriously, congrats. That's awesome. Beyond my sarcasm, that's good stuff.
Well, planning to...
And I'm sure you played a big role, Joan, because I've read your stuff, and it's... top-notch, obviously.
Thank you.
Planning to destroy America, it takes all hands on deck.
It takes all hands on
deck.
That
creates jobs.
And it does create jobs, so.
There you go.
All right, Marcos.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this because, both of you guys have been very active. Joan, you've been writing at Daily Kos really for as long as I can remember. And, because
I'm old.
Well, we're both old, frankly, and ever since my child was born, everything sort of collapsed, and I don't remember anything that happened prior to 5 years ago. But
child, drugs, you know, whatever
exactly.
He wants to call it.
Both, actually, simultaneously. They almost arrived at the exact same time.
in fact, it's almost like it was connected in some way.
Well, so
as someone who has kids, I can see that.
Right, exactly. So now, Joan, tell me, what has changed over the years, from... In the context, obviously, there's 18 staff members at Daily Kos, but what has changed in terms of the community? I mean, from just the... Because my sense is, like, there's has not been a totally straight trajectory for the power of the blogosphere.
I'm not sure how that ties to community.
Well, no, I mean, I'm curious as to what your sense is.
It's exploded. Which is sort of interesting to me. It's watching. I've been there, as you said, forever. I started writing in, something like March of 2004, after I lurked for a really long time because those people were really scary.
Right.
It started out with a pretty small group of extremely intelligent people who were just passionate about politics and knew their stuff. So it's expanded over the years to... the people who are still passionate about politics but are newbies, and that's kind of fun. It's fun to bring new people in and indoctrinate them in the great orange Satan's ways.
And, I mean, but in terms of, like, the larger, outside of Daily Kos, I mean, what is your sense about what's happened with the Netroots in terms of their influence and their size and...
I think the jury's still out in terms of influence. Obviously, we had Dan Pfeiffer from the White House here today, so we do have some influence in the Netroots in bringing at least a White House spokesperson to come listen to us.
Right.
And he heard a lot today.
Oh, tell us somewhat of what he heard.
it was confrontational. It was... a good expression of the frustrations of the Democratic base, because we're not just the crazy, fringy Netroots. We are the Democratic base, and most of what we're pushing for is actually the mainstream of public opinion here in the United States. And I think it's important...
By large majorities.
By large majorities.
I mean, do you think the Netroots is really the Democratic base?
Yeah, I do. Looking at the Daily Kos community, these are the people who knock on doors. These are the people who write checks. These are the people who are precinct captains. I mean, this really is hardcore activist Democratic base.
Because I wonder, I mean, I think it's a portion of it. I mean, you know, because I also think that, you know, one of the things that continues to be, the conservative, I can't remember what the name of the organization is, but they all seem to be in one, basically a room the size of this booth
in
the hotel, right online.
Yes.
They almost look like a parody of themselves. But, and I think this community, this convention has gotten more diverse as the years have gone on. But we still, I think, are not as representative of, like, minority communities as I think are... actually part of the Democratic base. And do you have a sense of that, Cliff?
Definitely aren't enough Jews. I'm pretty sure.
Well, yes, there's
that.
So few Jews here. It's like going to a bar mitzvah at this place.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Well, with that picture of you,
right.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm getting crap about
the
people
Jewish
should
picture,
know,
Sam.
People should know that we're sitting in a booth with a massive... it's actually taller than me, I think. Sign for Ring of Fire... with a great picture of Bobby Kennedy and a wonderful picture of Mike Papantonio and how would you describe it, Jim?
I describe a picture of Sam from Annie Hall.
Very geeky.
Very geeky.
Very geeky. You're much more handsome than that, Sam.
Did you hear that, Scott? Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Joan. It's about time someone noticed that I'm more handsome than that picture. But
it's for diversity.
No, I
want to answer your point.
Please.
Get past my goofy joke, which is, there's no doubt. I think we've made strides. I've noticed a difference. I didn't make it to the first one. I've been to everyone since. so that's what, 5 years, 5 years of these now, and it's definitely more diverse. I think there are a lot more women I see, definitely.
Yes, definitely. I think
but I would say minority community, yeah, I mm-hmm. still think, you know, nobody's holding anybody out. I think we're all trying to find new ways to engage others and whatever, but like much of American society, I think we're better than most of American society, but yeah, it could get better, and I think we're all hoping that it will, you know?
I think it has. Every year you see more diversity in our audience, so that has been progressing, but no, we're not there yet.
The most striking change that I have noticed over the years is that it's younger.
Yeah.
That there are more young people.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. It
now,
was,
I don't know if it's just
a lot
like,
of gray hairs.
I'm
in
getting
Las Vegas.
Older. Yeah. It really was, though. Yeah. I mean, it was the. I mean, obviously, the convention itself is bigger than it was that first year in Vegas, mm-hmm. but not. I mean, I think it's also the proportions of youth, you know, and by youth, I'm talking like, I don't know, like, you know, early 20s.
Yeah.
That to me is really stunning. And it also makes me feel old, which I don't appreciate.
That could be the hangover.
Yes, that could also be the hangover. Have you guys seen any? Have you been on any panels or seen any panels that are particularly interesting? Don't say no.
I had a rather interesting panel yesterday. What to do when the president just isn't that into you?
Yeah, this
that
was.
I moderated.
This is the panel that I really wanted to see, and I would love to hear more about. This is one.
Jane, Dan Choi, right?
Dan Choi, John Aravosas, and Felipe Montos.
All right. Well,
when
let's.
You want to talk about youth?
Tell us
find
who
Felipe. Get
first.
Him
tell
on
us
your
who
show.
All those people are, because I'm not sure that most people know.
John Aravosas writes at America Blog. Mm-hmm. He's a prominent gay activist who's done a lot to really push, particularly on DOMA. Jane Hampshire writes at Fire Dog Lake. She founded Fire Dog Lake. And Jane has been instrumental in pushing activism on lots of issues.
Right.
Very effective. Dan Choi, Lieutenant Dan Choi, was sort of, he's the poster child of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, much in part because he's willing to do things like handcuff himself to the gates of the White House to protest.
And last year, actually, at Netroots Nation, in Las Vegas, there was a really stunning moment where, and I think you were interviewing Harry Reid.
I was interviewing Harry
tell,
Reid.
Tell us about that.
I
just
talked with Dan beforehand, and it was coincidentally the day he got his discharge papers was the day we had this panel. And he came to me and said, you know, I've got this West Point ring. It doesn't mean anything to me anymore. If I can't serve, this is meaningless to me. He wanted me to give it to Harry Reid with that message. So I did. And it was incredibly effective, I think, for crystallizing for this politician what this issue meant to the individual service member.
And Harry Reid made a vow, too, didn't he?
He made a vow. And he kept that vow to have DADT repealed.
And to give him back the ring or whatever when
that happened. Right. When it happened. And they had that ceremony in March, I believe.
And so it was Lieutenant Dan Choi. And who else was on the panel, the final member of the panel?
Felipe Montos, who is Matos, I'm sorry, a dream activist, a dream student. He's one of the top 20 community college students in the United States. And he's undocumented.
And the Dream Act, is a piece of legislation that basically says if you're a child of immigrants who came to this country as a child, and you have either gone to college or mm-hmm. served in the military, you should get citizenship.
Right. Piece of legislation that, by the way, that was hugely bipartisan. Like immigration mm-hmm. reform, like the Heritage Foundation health care plan that became ours, until it became unbipartisan, Republicans discovered that Democrats supported it.
Right. And there were some Democrats who also didn't support it.
There were some.
Sadly.
I can think of a few offhand. But there were, at least from my memory, there were a whole bunch of Republicans initially with it. And then they got their marching orders that they could not be for it. And they all changed.
Well, because we all know the problem with undocumented immigrants who get college educations or serve in the military is that you just simply can't have all those educated or
well-trained,
patriotic, undocumented immigrants.
Well-trained, disciplined. Yeah,
it would bring to utter chaos.
That's what
so,
I
think.
So you should find Felipe, get him on the show. He's
I would
fantastic.
Love to do that, actually.
He walked across America.
Wow. Like literally walked across America.
Literally walked across America.
Well, so, okay, tell me about this panel. So the people, what happened?
You know, I've had mixed reviews. A lot of people were saying, man, that was so depressing. Because we all do feel pretty powerless still. All of these issues where we've made a little bit of progress. The Obama administration is no longer trying to uphold DOMA. Mm-hmm. The Defense of Marriage Act. So, you know, that's a little bit of progress.
Right. DADT.
DADT.
Yeah, right. Basically, I think a lot of, I don't know if I want to call them baby steps, but a lot of sort of, you know, Lilly Ledbetter. I mean, it's not to say that nothing good has been done, and I think we've all tried to give, at least, I shouldn't say everybody, but I don't come from a place where I just reflexively say everything President Obama does is not good enough and bad. But he's brought me to that place where I can't help but be critical because he's asked for so much less, in my opinion, than he could have gotten, has not been willing to use the bully pulpit to fight what he could get, has seemed to really enjoy much more putting his foot on the necks of progressives to back off on very mediocre legislation than putting his foot on the necks of blue dogs to say, you're Democrats, you better damn well vote with me. Pull an LBJ, make him come in the bathroom with him and say, you know, you're going to support. And so
that's what I do with my staff.
That's right, yeah. If you want your staff to do something, definitely go and sit on the toilet.
That's right.
No, that's right, I don't have any staff. So.
Right.
But I mean, no, I mean, seriously, I can't speak for you too exactly, but I think maybe you agree with me in that, and that's where those of us who try to be supportive, but you can't help but get depressed because you see what could have been done.
Right.
And that's where the room was yesterday at this panel, definitely, and where it was, I think, this morning with Dan Pfeiffer.
And so what were there any sort of solutions that were offered?
Be in your face. And that's what Dan Choi has done so incredibly effectively. As an individual, I think what Dan can show us is that, yes, one person can make a tremendous difference. You forget that.
Right.
And he's done it.
Well, you know, Johan Hari, I interviewed, who is a writer from Great Britain, when I had him on the program, and he was the one who wrote quite a bit about UK Uncut, which inspired much of the, I think it did in fact inspire the US Uncut movement. But he had a great story of that about seven women mothers who had protested the Vietnam War on some type of very snowy day outside the White House. And there was only seven of them who showed up. And they felt incredibly depressed because they felt like they had absolutely no impact. And years later, they ended up, one of them ended up reading, I guess it was Dr. Spock's, Benjamin Spock's biography or memoirs or something. And it speaks of the moment that Spock turned against the Vietnam War. And he apparently had been in the White House that day, looked out the window, and saw these seven mothers alone in the snow protesting because of their kids had been killed. And that was the day that he decided he had to come out
so
publicly against the war. And you never know what the impact of a single individual
story
could have. It's a really inspiring story.
I want to say one thing quickly because I think this is important. And Joan is an expert on some of this and probably can say if she thinks I'm wrong. But my concern at this point also is that we're not just doing this to say that this is what we want as progressives. There are certain people that say, oh, you're going to hurt Obama. I view this as we're going to help him. Because the truth is right now, if people have seen that recent Mitt Romney commercial, have listened to what Mitt Romney has to say, if Obama does not move to a more progressive populist position on economics and does not start talking about jobs first and foremost, I mean, out west, and this is where, you know, mm-hmm. Joan as a Westerner can speak to it, but, you know, from numbers I've seen, you already have polls in Nevada and some places showing Mitt Romney beating Obama, because Mitt Romney, with that Mormon, you know, with large Mormon populations in parts of the West, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, even Washington and Oregon, you know, they could that could be a vote. I mean, obviously, you know, that could tip certain balances. And so,
well, Cliff, wait a second.
Not now, you Washington, have to understand, Oregon, but certainly Nevada.
Let me say this. Mitt Romney has an advantage because he understands what it feels like to be unemployed. You're aware he is unemployed.
Well, that's
now.
Important.
I don't know if you've read this. He just gave a speech saying to a room full of that he's been unemployed
for a while now too.
He's
a 99er, I think.
Tough with your $250 million in the bank.
Well, I mean, look. First of all, you don't know how quickly $250 million can turn into $249.5 million.
That's true. Second of all,
let me just start with that, okay? And then secondly, it's like the stress. you're out, let's say you're going to your third or fourth home, and you're sitting there, let's say you're up in Aspen or something at your chalet, and you're just thinking like, oh my God, if I live to 1,000 years old, I could run out of money.
That's true too. I think it's also important to say that those jobs aren't just going to export themselves to China. Somebody had to be there to help that process along. So let's understand the stress and difficulties he went through doing that.
True sacrifice. True sacrifice.
But with all, even all the jokes aside, you can see him already running for the, you know, for independence and what he believes that global warming is somewhat man-made. He believes in job non-discrimination for gays and lesbians. He's trying to sort of thread that needle. Mm-hmm. And he, if he wins that primary and he starts talking about jobs all the time and hitting the president on the economy, and then you bring in sort of a little bit of the Mormon contingent and a few of those Western swing states, I see danger. Because I live in Ohio, and I can see Obama losing Ohio. And if he loses Ohio, he needs places like Nevada.
Right.
You know? I mean...
Well, and if you want to add to it, talking about the deficit and the need to cut potentially Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
Now we've got AARP saying, well, okay, fine.
Yes, wait a second. I didn't read, you know, one of the least I am informed I am about the news is when I'm here at Netroots Nation.
Right.
What tell me the story.
This is stunning, and I can't understand why. Well, who got to them? I think it shows that intimidation works. The House Republicans have been investigating AARP and trying to get the IRS to investigate them, saying that some of the products they endorse end up being kickbacks to the AARP. So what do?
For example, the entire Republican caucus.
Exactly.
Never
they
has
cave
kickbacks.
On allowing cuts to Social Security. I'm saying they will not fight cuts to Social Security.
I don't understand.
What kind of cuts they're talking about isn't entirely clear to me yet. Need to find that out. But once they've breached that
But isn't
that
this strange
down,
timing? I mean, isn't this strange timing, or is this...
It's absolutely strange timing.
I mean, why... This is not... I mean, Social Security is supposedly off the table, although, with that said, I am convinced that what is happening now with the moratoriums on the temporary reductions in the collection of the payroll taxes, that we're basically setting up.
Oh, we are
an assault on Social Security. Maybe in a year from now but.
It's perfect timing in that way. It's that now that we're talking about payroll tax cuts, suddenly the AARP lends their voice to this, and they were, I think, a lot of conservatives and, sadly, probably a few Democrats were worried that we were getting to a point where Social Security was going to be off the table. So now's the time you jump in and you make sure to keep it back on. So really, and remember, the AARP did support that wonderfully, wonderfully crafted Bush, prescription drug bill.
Right.
That had like the donut size, the size of the earth that left out people who were not covered. So this isn't the first time they've given in on their principles, I would say. Assuming they have them.
Joan, no?
Well, and what this does back to the original point, does he lose seniors as well? If Social Security and Medicare is cut under his watch?
Yeah.
Well, that is the big issue.
And circles clear back to how we're trying to help the president.
Yes, by trying to push him in a direction where he'll shed all the cautious middle of the road, let's do a little bit, talk about the deficit, guys, to realize that people don't give a damn about something that doesn't affect their daily lives. They care about something that does, like, you know, paying for food and stuff.
Their mortgage being underwater. 23% of homeowners in the United States are underwater on their mortgages. 23%.
Now that is, and so people should understand, the implications of that are are in terms of it makes people much less mobile. Because they can't get a job in a certain area, they cannot leave and move to another area of the country where they might find better job prospects.
Yeah,
it means that they have no means in which to. They obviously can't use their home as equity,
right.
To borrow against the equity. They are stuck there for a while, and their sense of their net worth is obviously much
and
less.
The consumer confidence gets killed.
Exactly.
You're not going to go out when your mortgage is underwater in most cases and say, all right, let's go make a nice big new purchase.
All right, well, let's say something more positive going forward.
Like, you know, there's a big balloon up there.
There's a lot of balloons in here. What else do you have that's a little bit more positive? Hold on for a second. Let me play some music so that you guys have something to... I don't have that with me. I've got
something positive. What's going on good in the world?
No thunderstorm this morning here
in
Minneapolis.
Oh, well, there you go.
It was a little bit sunny outside. That was very pleasant.
All right, well, we're still bigger than Right Online.
We're still bigger than Right Online. That's
oh,
good.
I should tell you this story.
Beer hasn't been banned
I ran
yet.
Into Andrew Breitbart last night.
I heard this.
You already heard this?
I heard that you were with him. I didn't hear the outcome.
Yeah, well, he was a little bit drunk. He was a lot, but
had
drunk.
He started freebasing yet when you saw him, or was that later?
No, I don't know. Listen, I don't
Is
know.
Is he traveling with sheep?
I'm going to tell you right now. I know nothing about any story that involves him doing anything with farm animals or massive amounts of drugs. I don't know anything about that. Let me just say that unequivocally, that if that's true, I don't know it.
Okay,
so
that seems
let
fair.
Me just want to be honest about that and up front, because I don't want anybody to get the wrong
about,
impression.
About that there was a sort of immaculate conception. Have you heard about that one, too?
But,
well, Hal Breitbart was born. It was similar to the Immaculate Conception, except for in his case, his mom got amoebic dysentery. And he came out.
Oh, God.
Ouch.
So
how did your discussion with
Well,
Breitbart
first
come?
Off, I made him buy me a drink.
Good
which
for
he did.
You.
Yes, because I figured if I was going to spend my time talking to this guy, I want free alcohol for it. And it was interesting because, you know, I get into Twitter wars with him.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, you're so obsessed with the idea that I'm from Brentwood and that I have a problem. And I'm like, well, I mean, you clearly do have a problem with Hollywood. I mean, it's clearly like an emotional, personal issue for you. What are you talking about? I just think it's wrong that conservatives in Hollywood, and he's, you know, getting like this, and I'm just thinking, like, God, yeah, I hope I can really get him to lose it here. And he's surrounded by this entourage of, like, weird, you know, conservo thugs. I don't know. Some dude from, like, you know, just like, oh, who are you? And I'm just like, buddy, what are you, you know, but then So he's going like, I just think it's wrong that conservative actors have their freedom impaired by David. I guess he's speaking about David Geffen, and he's listing
Annie
off
David.
all of these Hollywood people by first name. Sort of proving my point. Like,
all
wait
the,
a second.
All the actual
Stephen,
people
David, Jeffrey, and
all the guys that have rejected his screenplays.
Well, exactly. Well, that's my argument is that growing up in Brentwood, he always felt like he was a reject. And he goes, they're impugning their freedom because they are making it impossible for them to make a a living. And I said, so you're telling me that you are defending the rights of workers against the notion of economic coercion. You're telling me that you actually believe freedom can be impaired by economic coercion, which actually is a very progressive and stance. I mean, because in that case, that gives you all the justification for things like a minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, and all sorts of labor protections. And he just looks at me and goes, what is economic coercion? I don't even understand your language. And I said, well, do you know the word economic? Yes. I know the word coercion. And then he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And you're talking, and it
his
was.
His face got all red. And
yes. He started getting a little puffy and red. And then somebody came up and goes, Mr. Breitbart, I just want to say, because the bar is full of both those of Netroots Nation people, but also the left, the right out, you know, right, wrong, whatever the
Right Online.
Right Online.
Where I guess we're wrong online.
Right, I guess so. And it comes up and he goes,
very crafty,
Mr. Breitbart, I just want to thank you for coming out to Madison, Wisconsin. And I go, yeah, hey, Andrew, I got to tell you, that worked out very well. And he's like, oh, you're getting all snarky. And then he's very sensitive. You know, he's a very sensitive guy.
Well, he's another one of these guys that, you know, it reminds me of somebody that was like Ann Coulter or whatever. Such a thin skin.
Yes.
So great at dishing it out, but the minute you slightly criticize them, they just freak.
And so he started, like, having all these Right Online people come, and then at that point I realized, like, oh, holy shit, it's 2 a.m, and I've had now more gin than I can consume, and I've got to get up in the morning and do my program.
Yes.
But I'm hoping, to...
Breitbart's like, I get into have a to get up in the morning, collect my right-wing welfare check.
Exactly.
And that's early. They make me get up at 10:30 a.m.
Is he going to be on the show?
Is he going to be on the show? You know, I didn't invite him. I didn't invite him, but maybe I will sit him down and interview him.
I think you should.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be good to do. I think that would be good to do. Well,
and continue that conversation about economic coercion.
Well, yes, he really wants to avoid. He really wants to avoid that conversation.
The defense of ignorance.
He really wants to avoid that conversation because, at the end of the day, it is about his own personal thing.
Yeah.
When he tries to make it into a broader principle, he's starting to realize, like, wait a second, there really is
no broader principle than my resentment for the fact that I'm not very talented, and I was born around all these people that are talented. And
I contend that's what it is.
I really do. Because being that the organizing principle these days of conservatism is resentment.
Well, he was only talking about...
It's not unusual to find this. I mean, it's people that have failed in some aspect of their personal lives or whatever it may be, and they're angry at the world for it, and so that's why they become conservative. Somebody has to be to blame for the fact that they've effed everything up. You know what I mean?
And luckily, there's just a right-wing infrastructure to him fail upward.
That's right. And that tells them exactly what they want to hear, which is the world's fault.
Well, you know what's fascinating is that when you talk to this guy, you realize that it's his personal resentment of specific liberals. Like, you know, the thing that animates us, I mean, I don't want to speak for you guys, but I think the thing that animates us is ultimately at the heart of certain policies and changes and actual sort of ideas, and are, to the extent that we resent conservatives or conservatism, it is a function that they oppose those ideas. His almost like reason for being is a sort of visceral resent and hatred of liberals, sort of divorced from policy standpoint.
Right, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. It's his resentment. It's not policy. It's tribal. It's I hate these people that have made my life so terrible. And again, you could keep going. You see it in Palin. You see it in Coulter. It's a common theme. Somebody else is always to blame, and somebody else has hurt them grievously. I mean, they can say whatever they want one day, but somebody says the slightest thing about them the next day, and they're the victims. And that, right. To me, that is the organizing, uniting principle of conservatism. Somebody's done you wrong.
That's absolutely right.
Victimization and fear.
Yep.
You have to fear those people who are going to do you wrong.
They're right around every corner, and they're just going to keep hurting you.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me today. Joan McCarter, you can obviously read her stuff as McJoan.
No, not anymore.
What?
She's come out of the closet.
I'm actually me on Daily Coast now.
Oh, my gosh.
Joan McCarter. But, you know, I'll always be McJoan.
I actually thought your name was Joan McJoan.
Yeah.
I honestly did. I was like, wait, Joan McJoan. No, no, it's Joan McJoan. Oh, well, all right. Okay. I miss McJoan, but that's just me. I guess the world's changing.
And
Cliff Schechter, you are still at Cliff Schechter at Twitter.
I'm at Cliff Schechter. I'm some other places, too, but why don't we just leave it at that?
Wait a second. Before I let you guys go, because I refuse to have Chris Rosen on this program, which doesn't mean anything to you.
You're not having him on anymore?
We're not today.
Okay.
I'm still pissed that he's only been able to watch 10 minutes of Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy Reefer Cake wrote me a theme song. Did you hear it?
Oh, no, I haven't. I got to pull the Jimmy Reefer Cake song, but... Joan is looking with a horror on her face.
I come on these things. I do a Friday.
Cliff is here on Fridays, and so he is aware of what's going on here.
All the wackiness of Sam's show on Fridays.
Can you tell me a movie that we should watch?
No.
Come on, Joan. You've never seen a movie?
You want a fun movie?
Any movie. Listen, I got news for you. My movie segment on a weekly basis is by someone who seems to have a complete lack of knowledge about film.
Yeah.
I mean, which I think is almost, like, people suspect that either this guy it's just completely a comedy bit, or he has some type of, seriously, developmental issue. That's how bad his movie reviewing is. So I want you to say there's no pressure.
What movie
do you like?
What I most recently watched that I can recommend because it's going to be absolutely butchered by Hollywood, not to sound like Breitbart, watch the three Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, Dragon Tattoo, those in their original Swedish, because that actress just kicks ass. She is
all right, there it is. It's like the trilogy
books,
of those books.
The Stieg Larsson trilogy. If you liked those books, watch those movies, and I'd probably skip the American version, even though it's not out yet. But
that is a far...
It cannot compete.
I'll tell you something.
I don't see how it can compete.
You have just taken the entire aggregate of all the movie reviews we've ever had on this program and just put them to shame. The level of that, honestly, I'm not kidding. And this is, It's both a reflection on that recommendation and on the recommendations we've received in the past.
Well, I know it's awfully elitist of me to recommend foreign films, but there you go.
Well, we can do that.
They're thrillers.
We can do that. This is proof positive. You and Breitbart, very anti-Hollywood.
Yes.
Cliff.
Movie. Am I allowed to go back old school?
You can do whatever you want.
Okay. First, I'm going to give you two choices. One, for the kind of evening where you want to sit and just watch TV and be horrified by what you see and just enjoy movies for all their cheesy terribleness. That would be Salt.
Salt? Okay.
You want to see that and be like, wow, this is everything that the Bourne movies, that these guys want to be the Bourne movies and they can't possibly be. But I'm going to go with the other movie. I'm going to go with 3 Days of the Condor.
Touche. Touche.
Because if you
well
want to
done.
See understand what the CIA and some of these secret ops are up to right now, you want to understand what's going on out there. By the way, they filmed part of it in Peter Cooper Village, too, where I grew up. Very important.
Did you know that...
Go back, watch that movie, and see how it predicted... I mean, obviously, a lot of that stuff was going on then.
Right.
It was the 70s and the church committee hearings. But go and see where we are now and go back and watch that movie.
You know what's also fascinating? If you notice that the entire movie works on a pivot with the Twin Towers.
Yes, exactly.
You can
right.
see it from Brooklyn.
That's exactly
from
right.
Uptown
wow.
and
this
in front.
This
and that's
was
where
the mid to late. This is mid late 70s in the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
It just
this
been
was,
put
this
up
was,
in Manhattan. That's a great
I think they shot this in 1974. It is eerie to watch that movie now. Following
it's
that,
it's such a great movie. And it so
and,
predicts where
you know,
we are.
Same
and,
thing in terms of politics. The Candidate.
Yes,
is
right.
the best campaign movie ever.
Well, right now, somewhere, Chris Rosen is weeping and crying. Why can't he ever recommend a good movie? Joan McCarter.
Mick Joan McCarter.
I'm
Joan.
So confused
Joan
now.
Mick McCarter. Mick
Cliff McShechter. Thank you so much for joining us.
The Irish side of my family.
All right, so let's bring in here. We got two more people. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt, come. I want both of you guys. Sitting down now is Matt Filipowicz. Did I say that right?
No, he said it horribly wrong.
Philip
Sandwich. Hey, Cliff.
Matt Filipowicz.
Filipowicz.
Mac Philip. God, I can't even. Believe
Smith,
me, I can't say anything today.
Yeah.
I called Joan. I called her Mick Joan McCarter.
Well,
or something.
She's
I can't
Joan,
even
though.
Say that again, Matt. I'm
Filipowicz.
Sorry. Matt Filipowicz.
It took me so many times, and now I'm correcting people.
I am Nicole Sandler. I am.
That's not how you say her name.
God, don't even start with me. You don't understand. I have had had too much to drink last night. I was up too late in the bar arguing
Breitbart.
With Andrew Breitbart.
Oh, no.
So I didn't get into a physical fight with him.
No, well,
I want
that's
to. I want to end all speculation. Well, I sort of did. I did not. No, I did not. But there's the convention is still young.
I'm hoping I don't run into him because I really don't want a confrontation with him, and we do not like each other. But if I do see him, I'll thank him because he called me out on Bill Maher. He called me out on Real Time.
What did he say?
After I was arrested that week, and they were talking about the town hall meetings and all that, he actually invoked my name twice. Now he was projecting what he does on to me. So, Nicole Sandler was there, and then Bill Maher said something else, and then he said, Nicole Sandler, you know, she just tried to make a media event. It's like, you know what? Shut up. You don't know anything about me, but thank you for saying my name. It's kind of cool.
So now let's get this straight here. Now, Nicole, you are here broadcasting, doing your show, Radio or Not, which, of course, can be found at radioornot.com. Your tech setup is so sweet.
It's you easy.
Got, yeah.
But you know what? This little board you have, I have the same thing, only it's sort of half the size. It's
right.
Which is very simple. Yeah, I mean, it's easy. And that's the beautiful thing about the interwebs. Because
yes.
You can just, you know, plug in, and as long as you got a good connection, you can do it.
Indeed. And Matt, you're here. We're actually going to be sitting on a panel together. It's your panel you set up.
I am, yeah. We're going to be doing a comedy, video, and activism panel.
That's right.
It's got you, me, Liz Winstead, Katie Halper, Nagin Farsad, Andy Cobb.
When?
Andy Cobb.
It is Saturday at 3 p.m.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
So,
I will
folks
be there.
Nobody makes funnier videos online than Andy Cobb.
That's true.
He's the best. Mm-hmm. I love him.
And very funny stuff. So that should be a great panel. So now, guys, Nicole, how many times is this? This is not your first time.
This is my
second time. Give me your sense of what's your impression of it.
I love it. I think we have a great sense of community here. I love the fact that this is not a, you know, a cheerleading event for the Democratic Party. It's not yet. Rah, rah, Democrats. We are people who are We've got our own opinions, of course, we know that. But, you know, we've been pretty critical of the way the Democratic Party is operating, and for good reason. And I think, you know, most people just think, oh, it's like, the Democratic convention. But it isn't. And, you know, it's fun, too. We've got some cool people on our side. Fun.
And Matt, how many times have you been to this?
Three or four times. I'm trying to remember. I've been here a good deal. I did not go to Chicago. I'm trying to remember what was the one after Chicago. After Chicago, was that Austin?
Austin, perhaps, and then Vegas, I think.
Austin, Pittsburgh, Vegas. I don't know. Yeah, but this is my fourth, I believe.
And your sense, has it changed?
I think people are a little more comfortable around each other now, and I think there seems to be more of a community here. Like, I think that's definitely something that, like, when I first, or maybe it's just me because I didn't know people, but now I know everybody.
People hated you when you first came here. People really did not like you. I mean, that was one of the central things I remember
about that. There were riots. People were, locking arms to keep me from getting in here.
Oh, no, here it comes.
But eventually I won them over with my charming smile.
There you go. What do you get out of coming here? I mean, is it just?
It's nice, as part of, when you're part of the Netroots community, which we all are. It's nice to actually, we all have talk shows. It's nice to actually meet them face to face and actually,
right.
Actually get to have that kind of relationship with them. I think it actually when you see people and get to share a beer with them or share a conversation, the coalition builds, and it makes the whole Netroots stronger, because again, some of us you can just be doing on your computer naked like myself, because I broadcast all the time completely and utterly naked. I have to put on clothes to come here, which is something one does when one's in public.
WTMI.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But I think it's nice because you actually, it's a coalition builder. You get to see,
And you get to really get stupid and not, and make a fool of yourself.
Lots of free booze.
Well, hey, you know what? I mean, I'm glad you raised your show. Forgive me, but you do have a podcast.
You.
Well, yes,
how
I understand. I am moving very slow today. But please, tell us about your show. It is twice a week.
It's on Tuesdays and Thursdays. People can find it at matthewf.net. Sam was on Thursday's show, actually. It's a progressive talk show, but we have talk and in-depth interviews with people. Nicole's been on the show as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, we actually have my background is comedy and sketch comedy. We actually have two or three comedy sketches a show. I have a great team of comedians who do bits, and so the last show we had a bunch of brand new political ads for all the Republican campaigns. We had Romney's new ad, Bachman's new ad. We have Newt Gingrich's campaign manager will come on. Not really, but we'll have
right,
you know. So when something happens,
former or current? Or?
The current. The one that replaced the old one.
Nice. What was that guy? Was he formerly one of those QVC salesmen, or
you found him on Craigslist?
Right.
Oh, nice.
Nice. That's very funny.
Nice.
I don't have my normal movie my movie segment guy today, so I'm going to have to ask you for a movie selection.
Oh, I saw Super 8 the other day.
Super 8?
Yeah.
What's that?
That's the new. That's the new big movie.
J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams,
the
from Lost, and executive producer by Steven Spielberg.
Okay, no, you got to give me a movie that I can actually stream on Netflix
or
Amazon Demand, because I'm not allowed to go out to see a movie.
I see. Okay, so, one of the all-time great movies, which you've probably seen, is Being There.
That's a great one. I mean, I have seen it, but it is a great movie. Tell us
a
little bit about Being There. It's with...
Chauncey Gardner. It's with... Peter Sellers, thank you.
Sellers, yeah.
And Shirley MacLaine,
mm-hmm.
Who I got to interview once.
Really?
Oh, my God. She was so great because she wrote a book. And we talked about,
Was it about past lives or something, right?
Yes, it was about past lives. But you know what? We talked about Denis Kucinich and aliens because, of course, that's what the media centered on, because she and Denis Kucinich are old, old friends. He's like, she's a godfather to his, whatever. They're family friends.
Uh-huh.
And, at her home in New Mexico, they were out on the porch and saw something.
And how high were they?
They may have. I don't know. But do you not believe that there is life out there? Do you think we are the only...
No, I would imagine there is life out there, but I would also say that I feel more strongly that Shirley MacLaine and Dennis Kucinich out in the desert were taking drugs.
Yeah, I mean, peyote there. I mean, that seems inevitable.
Right? I mean, and maybe they did see something, maybe they didn't. That's almost secondary to what drugs they were taking.
But she was great fun, and you know, we talked about being there is one of my favorite movies because it works on so many levels, and you
it's
know,
a great
the whole
film.
Chance the guard. Mm-hmm. Chance the Gardener became Chauncey Gardner, and you know, I think we see a lot of people like that in politics.
Yes.
You know, all of a sudden he's asked for his opion because I like to watch. You know,
go.
I mean, it's so perfect.
Mm-hmm. Matt?
You know, the last movie I watched was actually Dave Zirin's documentary, Not Just a Game. It's based off his book. It's phenomenal.
Excellent. I didn't know. Did he make this himself?
He made
now, Dave Zirin's been a guest on the program.
Yeah.
He writes for The Nation.
The
magazine's
who
got edgeofsports.com.
Sports guy.
Again, it's one of those things where, like, I met him at the NCMR and I had a really cool interview with him. It's one of those topics that I actually think is one of the things that we don't do very well as the left. It's about how the left kind of ignores sports to our own peril, where, like, and how much sports influences politics, like race politics, gender politics, just like city politics, where like it's
right.
like the thing of like, you know, stadium building, where
right.
like you have like his main point in it is like, you know, when you have a football stadium that's being publicly funded, at most it's going to be used like, you know, 8 days out of the year. So
right.
they say it's so good for the community, but the stadium is only, the employees are there, it's at best a part-time job.
Right.
And then maybe you'll have like, you know, a concert will come in or something like that, but really it's something that's like a stadium's being used maybe 21 days a year and stuff, but the it's phenomenal. It's a really awesome film based on
the name of the film is
Not Just a Game.
Not Just a Game.
It's based off of his book.
That's
great.
Yeah, that's great. I hadn't even. When did that come out?
It came out maybe a few months ago. It's
well,
pretty new.
Then I want to tip my hat to my producers who were really on the ball in telling me about that. All right, guys. Nicole Sandler can be found at radioornot.com.
Yeah.
Matt Filipowicz.
Filipowicz.
Smith.
Filipowicz.
I can't do it. Can't do it. I'm going to have to take a break from this show. please don't tell me that your URL is mattfilipowicz.com.
It's not.
That would have been the, with all due respect, yeah. one of the world's greatest marketing mistakes.
MatthewF.net.
Yeah, I decided to not have people try to spell my name, and so MatthewF.net.
Or
kudos, kudos to you.
MatthewF.net.
Guys, thank you so much for joining me. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to play the we have our weekly songs.
Oh.
We have Jimmy Reefer Cake and also another song from David Benhoya, The Screaming Majority. Let me get those, fire those up right now, folks. It's part of the program, and we'll be back in just a minute with, this one's called, Can You Recall Scooter? And, I will be back in just a minute after this one's from the Screaming Majority, David Benhoya. I will first turn on the volume.
You sound like me now.
Screaming yes, there you go.
I have a goal every day of getting through an entire show with no technical
screws. Here we go.
Never works.
I can't
even tell. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, man.
All right, guys, I've been told that nobody hears it. Let me try that again. I don't understand why that would be the case.
That shouldn't be the case. Oh, that's why. Hold on for 1 second. All apologies, folks. Here we go. This is from David Benhoya. Can you recall Scooter?
Wisconsin brings all the cons in, squats on every ride he can find. Folks in Wisconsin can still recall when the government didn't use to screw us all. They can still recall your ass right out of your seat. This summer senators feeling the heat. This winter Scooter will see it repeat. Up like a rat from Badger Democrats, Scooter can't hide his sleaze. The Pack and Charles Woodson know they've got the goods on Scott. He cut the cheese heads out of their pension, thought no one was paying attention. Well, he don't know Jack from Cheddar. A cheese head oughta know better. Wisconsin can still recall when the government didn't used to screw us all. They can still recall. Call your ass right out of your seat. Republican senators feeling the heat. That little prick Scooter will see it repeat.
Call out the vote.com.
Oh, that, folks, was great. I love that song. You can recall, can you recall Scooter? It's a great tune. I apologize for any of the technical difficulties. But, folks, that actually, having technical difficulties is actually a great way to introduce my next guest, because without my next guest, I would have no technical difficulties. Because without my next guest, I would have no show. And there would technical issues would not be an issue whatsoever. Because there would be no show. And any technical difficulty I would have would just be just a technical difficulty with my own life. And I'd just be walking around and doing nothing. Now, why would someone call me now from Washington? Like, they don't... No, it's really annoying. And I would have no technical difficulties whatsoever because there would be absolutely no show. At last year's Netroot Nation, I think it was last year's.
Yeah.
A gentleman came up to me, but I think we'd reconnected like a year before.
Yeah.
Well, I should introduce you. Ladies and gentlemen, you are a little bit of a celebrity around here. We had a meetup last night.
Feeling like it.
And there was some, you were getting a little, you had some groupies.
Be that as it may, Sam.
Yes, Kyle Schenck, ladies and gentlemen. Kyle Schenck, responsible for the delivery, the construction. I mean, every technical aspect of this show is a function of Kyle Schenck. Not only did he create the membership system, the broadcast system, the podcast system, the functionality of the blog, donateyouraccount.com. He's about to release Taped, which is going to revolutionize the way you can listen to this program on your smartphone, Android or iPhone.
iPhone first, Android later.
Oh. Well, it was great talking to you, Kyle. Thank you for stopping by. It's going to revolutionize the way you listen to this program. In fact, all programs, audio podcasts.
Yeah, I just think it'll be a better way to listen. So, you know, it'll come out soon, and Sam will be one of the first beta testers, so he can tell you how it is.
Kyle, what do you do all day? I mean, honestly.
Well, I work from home.
You work from home. You're tweeting out like in the middle of the night about working on something that I don't understand what you're talking about. And then I go and I read the post that you've posted, which I don't understand what you're talking about. What are you doing?
Well, I'm a software engineer. So there's a club. So I'm part of that club.
Okay.
And basically, you know, we sit on our perches and talk very highly so as to not be detected by you, you know, folks like you.
Right.
And
you're speaking a special
code. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, my goal is just to – I do boring work during the day and then to have fun work, you know. And the majority report's been a lot of fun work, and so is taped and done at your account.
You've worked on – you've done a lot of work for blogs through the years. I mean, some of the biggest blogs, haven't you?
Like, yeah.
What have you done work for?
I've done work for America Blog. I've helped out Atrios from time to time. A couple years ago, he had an auto nighttime blogging system with open threads, and that was a little script running on my computer, which was kind of funny.
You had your computer running?
And well, I had a server running. But anyway, these open threads would go up in the middle of the night so Atrios could go out for the weekend. And it worked out pretty well. He would initially, he was very thankful he'd get away from blogging.
Yeah, I remember when that happened, how excited he was about that.
I'm kind of like a phantom in the middle of the Netroots night that goes from house to house and, you know, knocks on the door and fixes things.
You should be careful because you could get arrested for it.
Yeah. I come unannounced. But last year we met, and I said, you know, I really missed Breakroom Live and wanted to get you back on the internet. And I was going to go down, and then October came. And I was going to go
right. I mean, when you said that, I mean, I've been talking about doing something like this, but it's just like I couldn't, you know, frankly, you know, I am very daunted by the technical parts of it. And I couldn't afford to really sort of like go out and hire somebody on spec to build this whole operation because I didn't know where it would lead to.
Right.
You approached me at Netroots Nation, and I was like, oh, yeah, seriously. Like, you know, and I still was sort of, like, somewhat reluctant, but then...
Well, right, and I'm sure people come up to you sometimes and say, oh, hey, I could do stuff for you or whatever, and I hope I didn't come off as one of those people because I could actually do it.
Well, like my parents, for instance. Like, I will do, you know, like, whatever. I will support you, I will nurture you, whatever, and that never materialized,
no.
And I think I've since been very skeptical about
it.
So
I'm better than your parents, that's what
right,
you're saying.
Right, exactly, yes, okay. And my family. And so then, and this is actually sort of ironic, because Mark Maron actually
he affects the situation.
He affects the situation. Please, then what happened?
So I was following the what you know. Can I say what the fuck? Is that allowed? Not the fuck part, but can I even reference Mark's program on your program?
Right. It's not the swearing.
I want permission
it's more
to say,
the reference.
I don't want to plug his program.
We don't have to get specific.
Right.
There's some project that Mark was involved with that he's still
a project by
is currently...
a Mark somewhere.
Right.
And he was going to have a live show in New York, and I noticed that Sam was going to be on it. And I live outside of Boston, and I thought, hey, why don't I just randomly, for no reason at all, go down on the Accela train and go to this show? And I said to Sam right before I was about to go, the day before, because it was all last minute, I said, hey, do you want to meet up?
And I said, yeah, I'll take you to dinner. We went out to dinner, and Kyle was like, I'm developing this thing where I can make phone calls and do all this, and I can streaming. Oh, yeah, that's easy. And I was like, what? Are you serious? And that's the month later, the show launched.
Yeah, just 2 weeks later, we started the soft launch.
Yep.
3 weeks later, and then 2 weeks after that, we were fully launched. It's kind of crazy that we're, you know, 7-8 months into this now.
Yes, it has been amazing, and it's, you know, again, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that. This show would be impossible without your
work. Well, can I give you my theory on why I love helping all this stuff out?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So I feel like...
I mean, I would hope it's a little bit more than a theory.
It's actually a fact. The fact is, if I amplify your voice by helping you out, that affects way more people than I could ever affect on my own, doing my own thing, doing my own media project. And so that's a very rational reason to help you.
Yes, and in many ways, I mean, you know, that's why I do this, because
right.
I feel like I can, you know, there may be, you know, this audience, at least on a podcast level, it's not as big as a radio audience.
Right.
But at the same time, there are, I know, a lot of people who listen to this, and it shapes their views, and they are people who go and write, and they go and talk to other people, and they go on, sometimes they're on television programs, and...
Well, the story gets even more interesting. I mean, I owe you a debt of gratitude for even being involved in politics at all, because I was listening to the Majority Report original in the summer of 2004. Again, I took another random trip to New York, where I... somehow got on the list of a bunch of bloggers that were all the top bloggers at the time, I had like a very small blog, and then I came and went to the tank during the GOP convention 2004, and that's how I met everybody, and that's how I got involved in politics. And I came because I knew you were going to do a live show, and I knew you were a part of it as well.
Wait, me or Janine?
Both. The show was
right. Okay.
I got to be honest. It was mostly about Janine.
Of course.
It turned to you.
Of course. That's what everybody... I know. Of course.
But then I thought it was so cool. You brought your friends, you know, Cross and Bateman down to...
That's right.
...come down to that thing, and it was a lot of fun. So, you know, oddly enough, it's like, you know, two trips to New York that kind of changed things, and I went on to do a bunch of other political projects after that with the people I met.
Yeah, I mean, you helped out, like you said, Mighty D and...
Mighty D. I wrote the new version of Mighty D that's currently running... it's weird. I can't even remember all the stuff that I do until people ask me, but it's a lot of stuff, but it's good. So if you have a project out there, I'm probably busy, but you know, the idea is to, if someone needs help, I know that software stuff can cost a lot of money. My hourly rate is very high. And if you were to find somebody, it would probably take much longer to get the site up and cost you way too much.
Honestly, none of this would be possible. So I want to, I wish I had my 360. Here, I'll tell you what. I'm going to play the 1812 Overture. In lieu of having...
To get to where
I
want,
but I know...
We also have to talk about last night.
Oh, you want to talk about last night? Oh, were you there?
I
can barely remember.
I watched from afar. I didn't want to seem like a member of your entourage, you know.
Right.
Because we were hanging out, and then Breitbart showed up. It changed everything. The world shifted. And I saw this man who looked like a combination of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, Andrew Jackson, like a puffy Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And
I think that's accurate.
That alone, I was a little bit inebriated, but that alone held my attention. Like, I was freaked out that he looked like a puffy Andrew Jackson for a good half hour.
He looks a little bloated. I mean, you know, it's not
His hair is like a...
Yeah, but he looks like, it doesn't look like he's taking care of himself.
And he seemed, it was weird because he was interested in talking to you, but he also didn't want to talk to you.
Yes, that's true. We started to engage, and then, at one point, I just, he had a look in his face like, oh, shit. And then he just sort of tried to change the subject.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't stop laughing
at this point. And while you were talking to him, people were walking up behind him and taking pictures to get him in the picture, and then, get a picture with Andrew Breitbart.
Right, yes.
While you were talking to him.
Oh, that's funny.
People were even doing that. Everyone's very fascinated by what was going on.
Yeah.
And I kind of saw it as, Andrew Breitbart, for a moment, was like the new mayor. It seemed like you were needling him in the same way.
You know what? I'll tell you something.
Very perceptive.
When I do it with Marin, I just, I do it because it's funny.
Right, right, right.
When I do it with Breitbart, I do use similar techniques.
It seemed like the same techniques.
Similar techniques, but I do it because I feel like I'm actually doing America a favor. Now, I may be doing America a favor when I do this to Marin, too,
right.
But I don't feel that way. I just do that because it's like... in the same way that I would, breathe loudly while I was pretending to sleep when my sister was asleep to keep her from sleeping and drive her crazy. That's the way I do it with Marin. But when I do it with Breitbart, I feel like I'm actually, I'm being a patriot.
Well,
if I can get him to just sort of slide off his meds for long enough, I think that I've actually done America a favor.
Yeah, so I think, Right Online is happening at our hotel.
Yes, I know that.
Oh, yeah, so... On my floor, there was a bellman delivering books. Imagine a cart that normally carries luggage carrying books. And I was like, well, this is weird.
Whose book are they giving out?
And I didn't know. And then I came back when I was going to bed after drinking a lot and seeing this Breitbart thing. I apparently ran into another conservative guy. And I said, did you get a book? Because I didn't get one. Because I thought, I was left out.
Very well done.
And then he was like, oh, yeah, that was Condoleezza Rice's book.
There you go. Well, ooh. This is look. We are I have been to these now, six of these things, five or six, I can't remember. I don't even know what day it is. I have never seen books given out.
By a bellman?
I'm saying in terms of, they don't do that here.
Right.
The right pushes, these organizations buy the books, and then they hand them out at conferences like this, and that's the way they drive up sales. They simply don't do it here. Now, I don't, because there's nobody to buy them. We need some wealthy people, or we need to rob a bank, or we just need to burn it all down. I don't know what, but Kyle, I want to thank you so much for making the show possible. and being such a good friend to me personally, but and a friend to all these people who enjoy this show every day. There are literally thousands of people who pay nothing. Incidentally, good time to remind you to become a member. And
after you've heard my sob story,
right,
won't
this.
You please become a Majority Report member?
Yes, exactly. who would not be able to enjoy the show without you. So thank you so much.
No problem.
I want to welcome to the program Sally Cohn. She's here. Hold on, she's coming in. She's from movementvision.org. It's Movement Vision Lab. What? Sally, what?
Sam, what?
What is this? What is this?
Sam, Movement Vision Lab at
right.
movementvision.org is a grassroots think tank I founded going on 8 years ago to figure out and experiment with how to get the progressive left, but particularly the grassroots of the left, to be more proactive and know what we actually stand for.
And what do we stand for at this point?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly the easiest project in the world, Sam. I'm not going to lie to you there.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's sort of two things. Do we know what we stand for? Yeah, we do. You know, we know we stand for equality. We know we stand for, you know, equal opportunity. We know we stand for the idea that, you know, a kid born in poverty should have as much of a shot at the American dream as a kid born to Bill Gates. I mean, we sort of know it in the abstract. We know we believe in the role of government as a balance to corporate power. But in the specific, we've had a little bit of a hard time, and I think it's either because we don't know, but more likely because we're afraid to be honest about what we really think. We're afraid, we want to look moderate. We want to look blend into the political woodwork.
Do you think that's a problem here, though? I mean, do you think these groups of people here at Netroots Nation, that's a problem for people in the blogosphere?
No, but, you know, I think, well, two things. One, that's a great question. One, I think that within the blogosphere, one of the things that the blogosphere has brought to the left, so it's getting better, is the willingness to disagree. I mean, actually, I think a sort of liberal cultural aversion to disagreement are sort of, let's let a thousand flowers bloom. Every idea is a good idea.
Really? I just think like, you put like two liberals into a room, you get three opinions.
Well, that's exactly right. That is true because we have some, but we allow that sort of, you know, multiplicity of opinion to flower. I mean, we're sort of, I wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post recently, how we are endlessly tolerant. We're actually, you know, scientifically, they have proven that liberals are more open-minded, more open to disagree.
Well, almost by definition.
In it. Yeah, almost right. By definition. So that's really helpful in a cocktail party. It's really hard when you're trying to, you know, get on the same page about your vision and values, let alone your talking points, right? I mean, it's what makes it really hard to hurt us.
Right.
You know, I think that's part of it. And then also, you know, look, I love the Netroots, but the entire spectrum of progressive opinion and, more importantly, progressive values isn't entirely represented here. And so it becomes a tension. You know, look, the people in this room can't, or this building can't all agree with themselves. But then when you get out into real America, real people on the streets, unemployed folks, underemployed folks, poor people on welfare, etc., you know, these things are complicated. Just like everybody doesn't believe everything the right says, you know.
Well, who do you think, I mean, because I've had this conversation with people here, who do you think is particularly underrepresented at Netroots?
Oh, boy. You know, are we going to go here, Sam? I'll go.
But no,
here.
I think that's
Netroots.
Okay.
So, you know, look, I welcome anyone listening to challenge me on this, but I'll be honest, when I came here, I was hoping to be proven wrong. I was hoping to come and see a real diversity, a real racial diversity in particular.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I was talking about with Cliff and Joan McCarter is there has been a lack of racial diversity here. And I think that's probably true in terms of the Netroots in general on some level.
I mean, and we know that, you know, Jane Hampshire this morning was citing a statistic that something like 60% of bloggers, even on Fire Dog Lake, are men. I mean, we know that, you know, and let's be clear, Netroots is only a manifestation of a larger phenomenon. And the
right.
phenomenon, which I think I'm disheartened by and I imagine a lot are, is we thought that the Netroots writ large was going to democratize media and opinion. It was going to be this great savior. And the unfortunate reality is that a lot of the, you know, traditional hierarchies we've seen throughout our history have been replicated into the netroots. Have they been made better? Yes. But, you know, and there are structural reasons for that, obviously for the reasons that they're replicated in schools, in graduate schools, and so on and so forth. We're not immune from it. I think that's, at the very least,
What do you think the structural... I mean, obviously, I think the one of the primary structural barriers to a broader spectrum of voices online is simply access to high-speed internet. But, you know, I would imagine that that does not necessarily break down on gender lines. You know, it's possible that may impact some racial, you know, on some racial fault lines, but I would imagine not so much on the gender lines. I don't have the right statistics to pull out of my pocket.
You know, all I have are donut crumbs from this morning. But
I understand.
I suspect
I ate all the crumbs. I don't waste any of the donut.
Then I ate a second, and what was I doing? You know, I felt bad enough with the first. Ate a second.
No, it's all right.
All right. Anyway.
All right. Let's go.
My point is, but going back to the point, that you know. There are a lot of issues that make it harder for certain communities to have access to the same sorts of opportunities. And you know, the metaphor that always occurs to me is whenever I fly on a shuttle flight from New York, I live in New York, fly on the shuttle down to D.C., and who populates those flights? They are overwhelmingly, they're white businessmen in suits. They work for the private sector. And it's you know, partly about the history of, you know, racism and sexism in our society. It's partly about who has access to power. It's partly about who has the good jobs within those companies that they can do that. It's partly about, you know, they're the ones who are less worried about taking care of the kids and not worried about traveling. And all these dynamics play out. Women are not only earning less money, they're working extra hard. They're coming home. They're working the second shift still. So I think the gender dynamics still play out as
right.
the racial dynamics. It's just, it's about who has freedom to go online and say, hey, I'm going to tell the world my opinion. And we know that historically, again, I hope that the blogosphere is one of the ways that we're overcoming that. But we know historically that, you know, come on, white guys feel more entitled to get
right.
up there and be like, hey, let me tell you what I think. You
right.
got to read it.
Right. And my experience...
Nothing personal, Sam.
No, believe me. It's, you know, I mean, it's a struggle. I mean, frankly, on this program, I don't know what the percentage is, but certainly the majority of my guests are male. And I don't know if I could be any more conscious about trying to get more females on. And, but the, weirdly, I get almost to a person, to the extent that I haven't been able to get guests on my show, they've been female, weirdly enough, and there simply is not, the same amount of not so much pundits, because I don't do pundits that often as much as I do sort of just, bloggers or whatnot. And my favorite bloggers are probably, my single favorite blogger is probably a female. I mean, you know, I don't want to pick one.
Who?
You know, Digby.
Oh.
I mean, you know, there's a couple of bloggers that I like. I don't want to, you know,
but
Digby's probably been on my program more than anybody, at least this version. And so, you want to do it?
Can't do it.
Oh, okay. It's an uphill climb.
Yeah.
But all right, so that's
well, let's go back. I'm not making an indictment, to be real clear, of Netroots, nor obviously Sam of you. I love you. I love your show. You know, there's two things here at work. One is, yay to us, because I actually think the left, the progressive left, the white left in particular, has gotten more conscientious about these things.
Right.
That's good. That's a start. At least admitting we have a problem is the first step. But I should say, you know, as someone who does a lot on Fox News, who goes on Fox News regularly, it is does not go unnoticed to me that, for instance, the hosts, the not only the hosts, frankly, the behind-the-scenes people, the producers, et cetera, at a place like Fox News are notably more racially diverse than, say, on MSNBC. Again, not to indict MSNBC either. But, you know, Roger Ailes, for instance, for all the things we can say about the guy, you know, but that people do say, that I'm not saying, but people do say, Roger's created a mentorship program for women and people of color within Fox News to bring them up through the production, you know, realm and to give them higher positions of power. You know, so it is sort of worth looking at, you know, at what point we, you know, stop, you know, dissembling and start saying, well, what can we really do about it?
Let me ask you another. Let me ask you another point, because one of the sort of big stories coming out of here, or that I hear repeated, and maybe that's a function of who I'm talking to, is that you know what I'm talking about.
BLT?
Yeah, I can't do. I butchered Jones' name. The gay community, in the broader gay community, has been very successful, or at least moderately successful, or the most successful of any sort of liberal progressive movement of forcing the hand of the administration. And I and people are talking about this as a model for what the rest of the progressive community should be doing. And I think to a certain extent that there is a lesson to be learned there from a tactical standpoint. But my sense is that the social liberalism on some level, the administration uses this, and some of the Democratic Party uses this as a sort of like, here's a bone. When you start to complain about some of the neoliberal policies we have, here's a bone, keep you quiet. And, you know, I think the administration was clearly upset about the pressure it received on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I think that had more to do less with the idea that you were forcing our hand to do this, and more, we had this card that we want to play at a certain time, and we didn't want to play it right now, and you made us play it. And that's not the same for things like, hey, more stimulus. If you're going to have tax cuts, don't make it about Social Security. Make it about income taxes, because those are easier to raise at one point than they would be to get back payroll taxes.
Yeah, yeah, there's no question that the timing was, hey, look, we, you know, extended the Bush tax cuts for the rich, but wow, look, we're going to slowly over time repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, I wouldn't honestly, Sam, characterize it quite as black and white as you just did.
Right. No,
because, you know, obviously his stance on gay marriage hasn't been great. You know, on immigration, he's tried to stick his neck out anyway in support of comprehensive immigration reform and the DREAM Act. And on the other hand, you know, his deportation record and enforcement record is higher than Bush's. So,
right.
You know, but I think that there's something interesting, phenomenologically, if you will, about the gay rights activists and their sort of, you know, we're here, we're queer, we're pissed at you message. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that, you know, we are rather new to the insider club. I mean, it wasn't until Clinton, really, that the gay vote was courted. You know, so we don't have this long history of, you know, feeling funny but still voting and feeling, you know, you're kind of allied with the Democratic inside. You know, the women's vote, the black vote, they, at least along identity politics lines, go back a while. That's a long history you have to deal with, and a lot of muscle memory in terms of,
right,
you know, ongoing allegiance. Whereas,
well, there's
at
also
least more recently, gay people are more used to being kicked around. And I would say I think that's true with the immigrant vote and the Latino vote now as well. They're also not being as faithful to the White House, and I think you can see that.
Do you think that the strength of the gay community is an electoral one or a fundraising one?
It's that we're sexy.
No, of course, of course. But I mean, honestly, I mean, do you think it is actually in terms of votes or in terms of fundraising?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question, Sam. I'm not sure. It's probably some combination thereof. But I would also there's a third element, which I think is a sort of a moral suasion, and at least you know, when you're thinking about a litmus test, and it's always a moving ball for, you know, the American, you know, majority values, you know, what is equality and liberty, et cetera, mean to our country. You know, how the president, how the political parties treat gay people has been one of those sort of moral tests. And I mean it in the positive sense, a test of our character, a test of, are we the nation that we want to be? Are we the kind of political leaders we want to have? you know, at different points in time, it has been different groups. But I think that there's a certain, you know, the reason we hear the president tout his record such as it is on gay rights so much is he's using it as a proxy to speak to his shared values with those who care about equality and justice and fair treatment and opportunity, not just for gay voters. So there's a way in which I think it's a, you know, a metaphor, a symbol, if you will, and that has a lot of power right now.
Right.
You know, similarly, undocumented immigrants aren't going to vote, but they're a proxy for that sort of moral line in the sand and where the president stands in relation to it.
Well, Sally Cohn, the site is movementvision.org, movementvision.org. If we figure out how to get all this together, we'll try and put it on the blog. We will ultimately, but I've still don't. I haven't even listed all the guests that we had on yesterday. But thank you so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Sam, you know I love the show.
Oh, it's I'm great. Very yeah. glad to hear yeah. that. All right, folks. Now, before we're running out of time here, but before we go, we have, I'm unclear on this. Sends it too late. Jimmy Reefer, first off, we have apparently, this is a Cliff Schechter theme song. I guess I should have played this for Cliff Schechter, but, you know, what are you going to do? This is, the time to send me a new theme song is not when I'm on the road, people. But nevertheless, much appreciated. Let's hear it. Hopefully this will work. Wait, what was that at the end? I couldn't make it. Is that a plug in there for? Hold on. Oh, great! I just emailed. Dave Roberts. He is gonna sit down. Let's just play. If this Jimmy Reefer Cake song is the same one, did you hear it? It didn't come through? Son of a gun. All right. Well, we'll have to play it. I'll play it on Monday, folks. Because right now, stepping into the, it's not really a studio. It's a table with a skirt on it. Dave Roberts from grist.org. Is joining me. You don't have to email me that you're here. I mean, I can see that. Dave Roberts.
There's the mic.
Dave Roberts is joining me. Did you just arrive? Yesterday. So Dave, this isn't your first time Netroots Nation, is it?
Fourth
time.
Yeah, I'm a veteran, I guess.
And so your first time was back in was it Chicago?
It's all a little hazy now.
Yes, I understand. Listen, I just stopped drinking gin in time enough to get on the microphone today. So,
I know I'm a little haggard from yesterday, so I might not be at my best.
Oh, turn down. What's this? You want to put him on this one? What are you, Scott? What are you saying? Oh,
me? Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
There you go.
No more mumbling.
Give me your take. I mean, people should know that you. You focus, obviously, from grist.org, you focus on environmental issues. But you, when I think of people in who are associated with issues like that, but also have a greater sense of where that fits in the larger progressive movement, you are one of those people who really come to mind. Because it is rare, in my estimation, to find people who are so closely aligned with an issue, but at the same time appreciate that there are broader movement questions that implicate those issues.
Yes.
Does that make
yes.
sense?
Yes, it does. And it's always been one of my goals. You know, when I came to Grist, it was clear to me that the environmental movement and environmental media was pretty excuse me, siloed and separated and ghettoized a little bit, talking to each other. And not only the problem was that environmentalists weren't doing things right, but that progressives weren't paying much attention to environmental issues either. So it's always been my goal to try to talk to the broader progressive community about why, you know, defending the EPA or why a good energy bill is a social justice issue. It's an economic justice issue. It's about movement building. It's of a piece with the larger progressive movement in a way that I feel like they've become separated over the years. So I hope I'm making some small progress.
Right. Yeah, well,
that's a big, well, that's a big job.
Are. I mean, one of the things that is difficult for me, and I imagine, I don't know if this is an experience that, but in doing a daily show, or I would imagine if I was a blogger of sort of generally progressive issues, you know, one of the things that's hard is sort of, there are some environmental issues that are sort of more or less conversation stoppers. And I've had Bill McKibben on, I've had, I've had a decent number of environmental people on the program, and but there's, one point where you're like, okay, here's the latest report from the international, climate talks. And, we've hit that tipping point. We're going to get 2 degrees, and 100 years, really nothing we can do about it.
Yes, everything's going to hell, and nobody's doing anything to stop it. And, you know, we come back next week and say the
same thing.
And
now time for our movie review, folks.
I know, exactly. Checking in, everything's still going to hell.
Right.
No one's still doing anything about it. Yeah, it's
very hard to build a narrative there.
Yeah,
Act One is the same as Act Three.
Yes, that's correct, and that's why one of the things I'm trying to do, and Grist is trying to do, is to start telling more stories about places where things are happening and where people are doing things, which is mostly these days at the sub-national level. Obviously, nothing's happening at the federal level, but in cities across the country, there's an astonishing amount of activity. Like, mayors and city officials are so much more practical and pragmatic and so much less subject to sort of positioning and posing, because they have, you know, there's more accountability, direct accountability.
Right.
So there's an astonishing amount of stuff going on that's really exciting and is not this kind of eat your peas, you know, feel guilty kind of stuff, but stuff that's building social capital in cities and making cities funner places to be and healthier places to be, and that are interesting and vital, and they progress and they move and there's results. So I hear what you're saying. It's if you were paying attention to the Dan Pfeiffer discussion earlier today.
I didn't hear it, actually.
There was a question, which I was waiting for, the token environmental question. It was a good question because it came from someone in the audience who had written in. It was, you know, why isn't Obama taking a greater lead on climate change, and what's he going to do to defend the EPA? And it just fell flat. Like, almost every question throughout that session got applause.
Right.
And it just fell flat. People are like, oh, here's the token environmental question, and Dan Pfeiffer gave a bunch of word salad that didn't mean anything, and everybody moved on. You know, it's just symptomatic of, you know, everybody sort of feels guilty about it, like they should sort of pay attention to it periodically, but it doesn't really fire people up. They don't get, they don't get worked up. Like, the next question was about Guantanamo, and there's this huge outbreak of applause. For some reason, people feel super passionate about that, but very few people in the progressive movement outside of professional environmentalists seem to get worked up about these things. So
yeah, it's strange. I mean, because I sense that, I mean, you know, with the EPA though, you know, for me personally, because I think the regulatory structure in general is so important, because we're talking about curbing corporate power. I mean, to me, when I get passionate about the EPA, it's less about the environment on some level, and more about the idea that we need to broadly curb corporate power, and it falls into that rubric. And for life of me, I can't tell why, and maybe it's because it's just like I'm looking into the abyss here. And but it's interesting that you're focusing on localities, because I sense that is happening across the spectrum because of the frustration that people have had with federal politics.
Yes, and I think the failures of federal politics show that the left does not have the base, the foundation of social capital that it needs to drive things forward in Washington. And that social capital is built in local victories and local power, where people start to feel involved. You know, the 2008 campaign should have showed us that. But let me get back to what you said about the EPA, because this is what I think the larger progressive movement does not appreciate, that in addition to the environmental benefits, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act are just extraordinarily well-crafted and effective pieces of legislation that have produced enormous social benefits, economic benefits, health benefits, employment benefits, for incredibly small cost. Like, in terms of an argument for liberalism and making an argument for good government, those are our greatest accomplishments, and they don't appreciate them, and they're not working very hard to defend them.
And I think I just saw a piece, actually, that someone broke down the costs of
the cost-benefit ratios of the Clean Air Act are somewhere between, depending on what part you're looking at and what time frame you're looking at, somewhere between 20 to 1 to up to 50 to 1.
In a positive way.
The benefits to society outweigh the costs to business by, you know, orders of magnitude. And that's what you want out of good legislation, right? Like, that's what liberals want.
And I think, you know, there is also a real key in the way that we perceive these things, in the way that we frame these things across the board, because when you do a breakdown of the benefits of the Clean Water Act, too often we hear the story of, like, what cost it is to the corporation that must abide by the Clean Water Act. We do not hear those costs of, like, hey, there are thousands of kids who don't have some type of lead poisoning,
yeah,
or mercury poisoning, or there are literally tens of thousands of kids who would otherwise have asthma, mm-hmm, which, you know, it costs asthma medicine. Your parents got to stay home to take care of the kid. The kid needs maybe some special care, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
those externalities spiral
out, and they affect people's employment. They affect educational attainment. They affect, you know, I talked to a guy who has been working with the Chinese government on environmental laws. He's been helping them craft environmental legislation, and they've actually written a lot of great laws, but the central government over there doesn't have the power and the enforcement infrastructure to make the people in the provinces obey those laws, really. And they look to the EPA with envy. And I've had this conversation with people from several countries.
Of course, you can't say that in this environment, because then all of a sudden it's proof that it's communist.
Yeah, well... There are lots of countries around the world who would love to have enforcement mechanisms around clean air and clean water with real teeth and real infrastructure and legal infrastructure and enforcement infrastructure. The EPA is the envy of governments over the world, but we take it for granted and just crap on it all the time. Like, there's very few people outside of Lisa Jackson herself, even in the administration, who are making this a frontline issue. And it's a shame, because if liberals care about doing government right, the EPA is a model agency and a model series of bills and legislation. It's a great argument for liberalism, and it doesn't feel like it's being used that way.
And the irony of that is that it was started by a Republican.
Right.
I mean, it gives a sense of just how far to the right the central debate is.
Michelle Bachmann in the debate the other night just sort of casually dropped the idea that she wants to repeal the whole agency and just get rid of it, and nobody blinked. It wasn't even a soundbite. You had to dig in the news to even find out that she said it. It's not even noteworthy anymore. And that's just nuts.
Well, to be fair, you wouldn't have any threat to the ability to have kerosene come out of your faucets with the fracking if there was no EPA. I mean, you know, you're...
The freedom to have dirty water.
Exactly. The opportunity for the market to work out the chemicals that my daughter would ingest.
And you see the same thing around performance standards, fuel economy standards and performance standards for appliances, and using, you know, getting more benefit out of less energy, which used to just be a bog standard federal function. That was just what the federal government does, is set those kind of performance standards, and they've created incredible technological innovations and incredible benefits for consumers. But now you see in this light bulb debate that the right is having, I don't know how clued in you are on this. I don't recommend cluing yourself in.
Is this like
the freedom to have outmoded, energy-wasting light bulbs, apparently, is now a genuine rallying point on the right. Like, they're proposing bills. Joe Barton has picked this up as his issue of choice, because the federal government is creating performance standards for light bulbs that would effectively rule out old incandescent bulbs, although there are new generations of incandescents that would fit it. But this is now a rallying cry for the right, the freedom to have inefficient light bulbs, and there's no coherent pushback coming from our side on this stuff. They just leave it to the environmentalists, and I think what we've learned in the past couple of years is that the environmental movement is not big enough or broad enough to take on
right
climate change and performance standards and the Clean Air Act. It's just, you know, it's like a lot of government infrastructure, and this is one siloed special interest group, basically, that's been assigned to defend it and to handle these issues, and it can't be done by them alone. It has to be a progressive movement, core progressive movement priority.
Yeah, I mean, there are people, you know, there was a piece that Robert Cruikshank wrote in Daily Kos, and it was very much about this idea of coalition building on the left, and the idea that you need to have the ability and the willingness to really fight for issues that aren't necessarily in your wheelhouse, so that those people are in a position to fight for the broader coalition when your issue does arise.
Exactly. That's the social capital that I'm talking about. You need a movement that has a coherent set of priorities, and not just, you know, this silo fights for this and that silo fights for that. You saw it in the cap and trade bill, sort of environmentalists going out and vainly trying to explain this technocratic, difficult to understand law, having to basically build a messaging strategy and a movement from scratch, because they can't just go to the movement and say, this accords with your values of fairness and justice and health. You know, they don't have a movement ready to go, whereas the opposition to cap and trade, they just go and say, look, this is another tax. It's another evil socialist plot. And boom, you got the messaging ready, the groups ready, the infrastructure ready. It's all ready to go.
Do you think that on the left there is a similar sort of a focal point? I mean, because everything on the right boils down to, this is another tax, this is an impingement on freedom. I mean, there is basically nothing that they argue for that they cannot apply those those two small little, you know, sort of, yep, like, you know, this is an impingement on my freedom. Is there something on the left? Because it strikes me as I hear you talking, and, you know, there's a couple of stories that I've seen recently that even that the anti-corporatism, or the corporatism is a... because obviously you saw Russ Feingold speak last night. That seems to be a rubric. Oh, you didn't.
Oh, God.
That's why I'm so hungover today. I should have been.
And but Russ Feingold. Is there a rubric? Is it corporatism? Is it curbing corporate power? Is it something else?
Well, this is an interesting question. I just came actually from talking with some people at Move On, and they're getting ready to start this what they're calling the American Dream.
June 23rd, right?
Movement. I'm not sure exactly when it cranks up or what all the pieces are, but it's an attempt to give some coherence to...
It's actually on our... It's June23rd.org.
There you go.
This is worth it. They're going to be very
inadvertently
happy.
Do an advertisement for Move On, but everybody should check that out. But it's an attempt to cohere these groups, and as to what it would be around, my sort of quirky, idiosyncratic take on that is that... I like a place-based focus. I like the idea that, you know, because the right has basically suburban and rural, angry, middle-aged and older white men. They're very, at this point, they've become a very homogenous party, and that gives them a sort of built-in, it gives them a built-in unity, a built-in single voice. They all have a shared set of experiences. And so the left, meanwhile, has... You know, gays, minorities, knowledge workers, working class, union guys, you know, just all these disparate groups with nothing to really cohere them around a shared set of priorities. My idiosyncratic take on this is that all those constituencies of the left live in cities. They're urban constituencies, and they all want to live in great places. And there are ways to make the places they live more sociable, more healthy, more sustainable, And so I like the idea of a national movement built around a place-based focus. But this is, you know, there's a series of posts up on about it now. So it's slightly idiosyncratic, but I don't hear from anybody else, I don't think, work hard and play by the rules and you can feed your family is an inspiring, you know, part of what the right is so fired up about is they feel like they're engaged in something that's larger than themselves. They're trying to recapture the glory of the country or whatever. They have a larger narrative that's beyond their immediate interests. What are we for? What do we want the country to look like in 2050? You know,
The conservative movement is, they are almost by definition zealots. almost literally zealots, which helps. But it's interesting because I've never, I haven't heard this articulated. I want to talk about this a little bit more. The idea of organizing messaging around the idea that you're talking to primarily urban dwellers. And that would be, you know, anybody who's living in a city of maybe could be as small as like 7,000-10,000 people if there is a... I lived for several years up near Hudson, New York. It's a very small town, but there is an urban quality to it where people can buy their groceries and walk up the street, and you could live most of your life, more or less, with a bicycle.
Well, if you look at the electoral map, the state electoral map is incredibly deceptive. The red and blue states. If you look at the county level map, what you see is that we have a sea of red with islands of blue, and those islands of blue are cities. So that's where the Democrats are. But because we have these, you know, a bunch of governmental structures that wildly overrepresent rural areas, the Senate being the main one, we have to, you know, put John Kerry in a hunting vest and pretend like we watch NASCAR and... You know what I mean? But I think it's time now. All the demographic trends are in our favor. The country is becoming more urban, more minority. People are marrying later. They're having fewer children. They want to go live in cities. Old people, baby boomers, want to return to cities now because they're getting stranded out in the suburbs with crappy transportation options and socially isolated. So the demographic trends are all in the direction of urbanism. And I think it's time... If we want to get out ahead of that, to just say we're an urban party, we favor the urban values of tolerance and living together in peace. We want to help create walkable, sociable areas where people are physically healthier, they're socially healthier. Nothing is a bigger determinant of quality of life, including money, than social connections. And people who live in urban, dense urban areas, by definition, by structure, have more social connections. They run into people more often there. So these, to me, urban values are a way of drawing together the interests of all these disparate left constituencies.
It's interesting because that type of strategy has not only both a message built into it, but also sort of tactical implications. You know, we don't have to buy media in certain areas you don't have to. Not only do you talk about certain issues that impact people's lives, but you also know it also provides a built-in delivery mechanism on some level, too.
So the question to me is, and this is the question I've been wrestling with on the blog a little bit, is what could a national movement do to for local efforts? Because a lot of these things are determined by local zoning laws and state and local laws, and there's not, the feds could do a lot more to direct money to urban areas. That's an obvious priority. But what do we do to sort of help there be knowledge sharing and a sense of solidarity among cities that are all trying to move in the same direction? And you go anywhere in the country, even small towns with Republican mayors, they are reviving waterfronts, they're reviving downtown walkable, you know, business districts. Everybody wants to live in a better place. It's a human thing. And if we can capture that and make that political, you know, show people that it is political, it's not just their idiosyncratic town that they're working on, they can be part of a larger movement where of other people who want the same things for their families and their communities. That's politically potent, and it gives us something forward looking that we're building rather than just defending the New Deal against a tax, which is important but gets dreary after a while. You know?
I would
like to tell a story about what we want and what we can offer you, you know, other than just defense from degradation. You know, we can offer you a future that looks nice. It's walkable, livable, sustainable urbanism. To me, is ought to be the future of the Democratic Party. Although you still have the Senate to contend with, but. Anyway, that's a
well, germ it's
of
very
idea.
Interesting. Dave Roberts from grist.org. Folks, you can read more about it there on Grist. Thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate
it's been
it.
Great.
Always
a
great
lot,
to
Sam.
Talk to you. All right, that's it, folks. For me, this little extra bonus time for the weekend. 15 minutes we went over today on the program. You will have a little extra bonus time for those of you listening on the podcast. And so have a great weekend. I will talk to you on Monday, and I promise to play the Jimmy Reefer Cake songs on Monday. All apologies, Jimmy Reefer Cake.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow.
Have a great weekend, folks. See you on Monday.
I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in.